So you are the ones who decided to stick it out. That's good. Time to continue talking about the brain. And we made it up to slide 9, but I haven't mentioned anything about this yet. In the previous slide, just to remind you, we were looking at the brainstem and the diencephalon. In slide 9, I don't want to get bogged down in all the anatomical details here and exhaustively go through this list. I just want to show you what's going on here. These are slices of the brainstem taken at 3 different places, which are indicated by the little glass planes showing you how the thing is sliced and where. So there's a slice in A through the midbrain, slice in B through the pons, and slice in C through the medulla oblongata. And just gives you an interior look at what these things contain. For one thing, notice up in the midbrain that the arrangement of white matter versus gray matter that we saw in the cerebrum, which was gray matter superficially and white matter deep, which is opposite to what it was in the spinal cord, that really only applies to the cerebellum and the cerebrum. By the time you get to the brainstem, it's already reversed to what it is in the spinal cord. So gray matter deep and white matter around that. I didn't mention last time when we were talking about the midbrain, and you can see this in little brackets up there in A, that the back part, the posterior part of the midbrain, is called the tectum, a word that means roof. Whereas the part that wraps around in the front is called the tegmentum. Those are the two major parts of the midbrain. And you might remember from the previous chapter when we were talking about pathways that there was a pathway called the tectospinal tract. That's named for the fact that neurons travel from the tectum down to the spinal cord. And in all 3 of these slices, you see a region, and it's not a real distinct region, but it's a region in all 3 of these slices that is labeled the reticular formation. I'm going to describe the reticular formation more fully in the next slide. But the reticular formation is a loose arrangement of neurons all through the brainstem, so all parts of it, which is why you see it at all 3 of these levels. And why do you suppose it's called the reticular formation? Right, there's a lot of branching, or the appearance of branchings. Remember, branching in terms of the flow of information can actually be tributaries as well, right? A lot of convergence or divergence would still be considered branching. Another thing that you see from this slide is that quite a few of the cranial nerve pairs that we're going to discuss at the end of the chapter connect to the brain somewhere at this brain stem. More so than what you see here, just because of where these particular slices are. That's why you don't see all of the cranial nerves that connect somewhere to the brainstem, but you can see some connecting at each of these 3 levels. For instance, the oculomotor nerve, which is number 3, connects up at the midbrain at that slice. You can see the trigeminal nerve in the pons section, and you can see the hypoglossal nerve here. There are others as well, and you'll eventually learn those. But of the 12 pairs, many of them connect directly to the brain somewhere at this brainstem. And the rest of the structures are largely nuclei. For instance, you see cuneate nucleus and Gracil nucleus. Do you remember when we used those words talking about pathways? We called them tracts then. Well, this is the nucleus that it corresponds to. What's the difference between a nucleus and a tract? No? That's right. What she said is correct, which is that a nucleus is a group of cell bodies in the central nervous system. So it's analogous to a ganglion, only in the central nervous system. And a tract is a group of axons in the central nervous system. So it's analogous to what in the peripheral nervous system? A nerve, right. And so notice that we call the cranial nerves nerves for good reason. They are not part of the brain. They connect to the brain. But where you see those yellow labeled, those yellow structures labeled as cranial nerves, those are part of the peripheral nervous system, which is why they're called cranial nerves. There are tracts, though, that they connect to, and those are properly called tracts because by the time you call them tracts, they are actually part of the brain or the spinal cord in certain cases. So there are various nuclei here that you see in this overall bundle of structures that we collectively call the brainstem, and a lot of connection points for cranial nerves. And like I said, I don't want to exhaustively go through these pieces for you. Let's talk more about the reticular formation, though. This is slide 10. Like I said, the reticular formation is a loosely arranged group of neurons. They actually are surrounded by other neurons, or other kinds of neurons are running through this reticular formation as well. So the reticular formation is not something that you can easily point to as a structure. It's a collection of neurons with other neurons that are actually not part of the reticular formation running side by side. And so that's what I mean by a loose formation of neurons. They're important pathways, though, for information as being represented here by the arrows. The reticular formation, since it occurs in all parts of the brainstem, is really important for getting information from the spinal cord to higher parts of the brain and from higher parts of the brain to the spinal cord. And that's in keeping with the anatomy of the brainstem, which is where the reticular formation is, right? The brainstem is really the connection point between the cerebrum and the cerebellum, two major brain parts, and the rest of the central nervous system, which is the spinal cord. So information, a lot of that information coming up from the spinal cord going to cerebrum or cerebellum passes through the reticular formation. We can see auditory and visual input just as examples here of sensory input. Well, almost all sensory information eventually passes through the thalamus. The thalamus is a major sensory relay center. So almost all of it. Now, most of the olfactory information, which is information coming from your nose, sensory information coming from your nose, skips the thalamus, but even some of the olfactory information goes through the thalamus, and all the other senses go through the thalamus. But as you see here, in getting to the thalamus, they also pass through the reticular formation largely. The thalamus then gets this huge amount of incoming sensory information and basically deals with it through integration. In a sense, decides how much of it is going to be allowed to make it to the cerebrum where the sensations are actually created. Keep in mind that there is a difference between sense and sensation, right? Sense just refers to incoming information. You're not aware of all of that. What you are aware of are sensations that are created in your cerebrum in response to incoming information that passes through the thalamus, is what I'm trying to say. But it also passes through the reticular formation to get to the thalamus. So that place where all of these blue arrows are radiating from is what? It's the thalamus. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The thalamus is that yo-yo shaped structure of the diencephalon. That's the major sensory relay center. Okay, let's go on. Oh, by the way, this is a mid-sagittal section, right? You recognize that, hopefully. So if you look at that thalamus, you're looking at the inside of one lobe of that yo-yo-shaped thalamus, right? One side of it. What's that little circle that's in the middle of it? It's not the hypothalamus. No, the hypothalamus is the triangular region just to the lower left of the... It's not the amygdala. No. We're going to talk about the amygdala, though. I just said this once, I think, so this is kind of... I'll be impressed if anyone knows. It's the axle of the yo-yo, right, that holds the two pieces of the yo-yo together. What did I say that's called? It's called the interthalamic adhesion. Okay, because it sticks the two pieces of the thalamus together. And the reason I mention that is because that interthalamic adhesion is brain material, neurons, and so are the lobes, and then the space that where you would put the string around that interthalamic adhesion is what? What is the space that surrounds the interthalamic adhesion medially? The third ventricle, exactly. Okay. Now we can go on to 11 and talk about the cerebellum. The cerebellum means what?
Little brain.
Little brain, right. Of course, it's all part of the one brain that you have. You don't have distinct brains. But as I was talking about when I first mentioned it, the cerebellum gets that name because it's arranged... I mean, it superficially looks a little bit like a small version of the cerebrum because the cerebrum has those folds in it. What are those folds called on the cerebrum? The hills. What are the hills called? Gyri. And the valleys between them? Sulci. Plural of sulcus. So you have a gyrus, another gyrus, and then the groove between them is a sulcus. That's on the cerebrum. On the cerebellum, notice that the little folds or the little hills are called folia. What does folia mean? Leaves. Right? Foliage. So these look like the little leaves or pages of a book. On end, right? That's why they're called that. And I'm referring here to the posterior view. So we're looking at this thing from the back. And the rest of the brain has been removed. So this is just the cerebellum. It also resembles the cerebrum in that it is hemispherical. There are two major sides. Okay, so we have a cerebellar hemisphere on the left and on the right. And there's even a crack between them, although not nearly as deep as the longitudinal fissure between the two cerebral hemispheres that we already discussed. In that crack between the hemispheres, though, the cerebellar hemispheres, is this structure called the vermis. Any idea what vermis means? No. It's the same word that's used in... Well, you probably just call it the appendix, but its real name is the vermiform appendix. Vermiform means shaped like a worm. Vermix means worm. And so this looks like specifically a segmented worm. Not all worms are segmented, but this looks like an earthworm, right? That's why it's called the vermis. And there are lobes on these hemispheres, just like there are on the cerebellum as well, although not as many. Well, that's the posterior view. If you look at it in mid-sagittal section, or median section, which is the same thing, as above, first of all, you can see its spatial relationship to the brainstem, and the pons lines up very well with the cerebellum, although the pons isn't as big vertically as the cerebellum is. But as I said before, where that pons and cerebellum come together, that's exactly where you find the triangular fourth ventricle. Okay, so that fourth ventricle, the brown that's indicated there, it would be cerebrospinal fluid. Now, in the cerebellum itself, when we look at the cross section, we get a good view of the fact that superficially, the cerebellum is made up of gray matter, and deep, it's white matter, just like in the cerebrum. And the white matter of the cerebellum, as you can see here, very much looks tree-like. The branching pattern of the white matter looks very much like the branches of a tree. And so this overall section looks like one tree, kind of on its side, but it looks very much like a tree, which is why it's called arbor vitae. The white matter of the cerebellum is called arbor vitae. What does that mean? Arbor is tree. What about vitae? Vital. Life. Vitae means life. Arbor vitae is the tree of life. That's what it literally means. So that's the white matter. And therefore, that's where you have the myelinated axons. The gray matter, which is superficial to it, is non-myelinated axons for some of the gray matter, but what else? What is gray matter in general? Not just in the cerebellum, but anywhere you see gray matter, you have non-myelinated axons potentially, but what else? Cell bodies. And the cell bodies could be of neurons that are either myelinated or unmyelinated, because even in a myelinated neuron, it's only the axon that's myelinated, not the cell body. Okay? And often the cell bodies are all put together, right? Which is why they make a mass of gray matter. And that's why you have such things as ganglia, group of cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system, and in the case of the central nervous system, nuclei. Okay? By the way, I use the word superficial and deep. When you have a structure, and it doesn't have to be part of the nervous system, for instance, the kidney is like this. When you have a structure that has a layered appearance, the superficial layer is distinct somehow from the deeper layer. What is the word that we use to refer to the superficial layer? Okay, well, thinking about the cerebrum in particular then, what do we call the surface of the cerebrum? The cortex, exactly. Cortex is a general word. And so there is a renal cortex. That's the superficial part of your kidney. If you make a coronal section of your kidneys and then open them up so you can see the interior, you see that the superficial part is different from the deeper part. And so that superficial part is called the cortex. That's why we call it the cerebral cortex. It's the superficial part. What's the corresponding name for the deep part in general? Are you saying something? Oh, you are. Okay. Medulla, correct. So there's a renal cortex, there's a renal medulla. That's the deeper part of the two. And notice the medulla oblongata is a deep part of the brain. All right? So those words, we usually use them. I mean, I just wanted to mention that because a lot of people think of them only in terms of the nervous system, but they really are general terms that are used outside of the nervous system as well. Now, what did I say is true about the cerebellum in terms of neurons? It does have a hell of a lot. Yeah, over 100 billion neurons just in the cerebellum. Over half of all brain neurons just in the cerebellum. And the cerebellum, we're still learning about, is responsible for some conscious processing, although that's really mostly the job of the cerebrum. But one thing we know is that the cerebellum is very highly important in coordination of motor activity. Now, for instance, you surely have heard or maybe even used the phrase muscle memory, right? Like an athlete that in a sport in which they can do exactly the same thing over and over, like diving, right? It's always the same, or bowling, at least for the first roll. Muscle memory refers to the fact that your body actually learns and remembers how to do a complicated set of activities, learns to hone that so that you're doing it exactly the same way every time. Cerebellum is really important in that. The cerebellum, functionally speaking, acts as a comparator. This is a term from electronics. What is a comparator? Well, as the name indicates, a comparator is something that compares two values. So you have, in a sense, a set point and a measurement, just like in my description of feedback. Right? A set point is what you want. The real value is what you have, and there might be an error between those. In order to compute that error, you have to compare the two values. And this is what the cerebellum does for many of your motor activities. Okay, so you come up with the intention to move a limb or some part of your body, for instance. That occurs in the cerebrum. But that information gets sent to the cerebellum, so it's now aware of what the set point is, in a sense. As you start to move, which involves information coming from both the cerebrum and the cerebellum, down the spinal cord and out through the peripheral nerves to the muscles, your proprioceptive neurons are continuously sending back information about where that limb is now compared to the previous instant. Okay, so you're aware. Remember what proprioception is? What is proprioception? Yeah, it's sensory information about the placement of your body parts. So when you move a limb, you're continuously measuring where it is moment to moment. I don't mean second to second, I mean millisecond to millisecond. And so when you make that first movement as the result of an intention to move a muscle, it might be not quite the right speed or strength or something like that. And therefore that comparator function of the cerebellum says we need to make an adjustment. So you make adjustments continuously during that what seems like just one movement, you're really continuously adjusting that over and over. That requires a lot of computing power to do that. It's similar to anti-lock brakes, for instance, in a car. Anti-lock brakes work because they're continuously sensing whether there's slippage or not many, many, many times a second. Computing, and then if necessary, making an adjustment to the pressure applied to the brake, to the rotor. Like I said, that takes a lot of computing power, and that's why the cerebellum is chock full of neurons. They're not particularly long neurons necessarily, but there's just a hell of a lot of them. Okay? I won't get into that. I was going to, but I won't. Let's go on to 12. In 12, we're looking at the diencephalon again. And what are the members of the diencephalon? What is it? Thalamus. And then a bunch of things named for their proximity to the thalamus, right? Which are what? Hypothalamus. Epithalamus. And subthalamus. Those are all parts of the diencephalon. Well, in the top picture, you're seeing the thalamus itself, so not the entire diencephalon. And you can see that the two halves, that's kind of the yo-yo appearance I was talking about. Some books will call them separate thalami, so there's a left thalamus and a right thalamus. Other books will say that there's one lobe of the thalamus and another lobe of the thalamus and call it just one thalamus. But in any case, there's two lobes making up this structure. And the color coding here, notice on the key to the right, corresponds to nuclei. The thalamus is full of different nuclei. So once again, these nuclei, as all nuclei in the nervous system, are groups of cell bodies. Now, as far as wiring is concerned, what's different about a nucleus compared to a tract? We already said what the difference is in terms of what it contains. But functionally speaking, what's different about what's going on in a nucleus compared to what's going on in a tract? Yes, that's part of it. In a tract, which are just axons, right? Either axons are firing or they're not. They're sending nerve signals as trains of action potentials, or they're not. But at the cell bodies, which are in the nuclei, you have connection points with those cell bodies, right? The cell bodies are where you find the dendrites in general. And the dendrites are the receiving ends of the neuron. That's where you have a bunch of synapses. Now, we studied it as being one or two synapses, but there can be tens of thousands of synapses upstream just on one downstream cell body at its ganglia. And therefore, functionally speaking, what's happening at nuclei that's not happening at tracts? What process is occurring there that's not occurring at tracts? Well, yeah, local potentials are being applied. But in terms of overall nervous system functions, integration, exactly. Integration occurs at nuclei, right? Because integration occurs where you have synapses. That integration is the sophistication of the nervous system. That's the high-level processing. That's what makes it a computer rather than just a circuit. Right? You can have an electrical circuit that doesn't have any computing power if you just set up wires. Well, that's what axons are like. And so in tracts, you have transmission of signals, but you don't have processing of the signals. Because the processing, the integration, requires synapses. That's occurring at the cell bodies. That's the importance of gray matter. So this applies to the cerebrum as well, right? The cerebrum, with its superficial gray matter, you know, gray matter is famous. We kind of use gray matter as a synonym for intelligence. you say things like it's going to require a lot of gray matter or something like that. Well, that makes sense because the gray matter is where that integration is taking place. The white matter is just sending or receiving, sending the information to or from the gray matter. Okay, but anyway, back in this thalamus, there are many nuclei, as you see here. It's chock full of nuclei of different sorts, and I'm not going to exhaustively go through the names of these nuclei or their specific functions, but know what I've already told you, that the thalamus as a whole, including its nuclei, is the major sensory relay center in the brain. So effectively all but some olfactory information, all other sensory information passes through the thalamus on its way to the cerebrum. But the thalamus doesn't create sensation. So it receives this incoming sensory information, filters it so that not all of it receives the cerebrum, so the cerebrum isn't confused, basically, or overwhelmed. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's occurring, that sensory information, that you would have the ability to be aware of. You know, like some sensory information you're never aware of. You don't really feel it or whatever, like your blood pressure. That's sensory information, but it's not sensation. You don't have the sensation of blood pressure. Okay? On the other hand, there's a bunch of visual information that's coming in all the time that you could be made aware of and therefore have a sensation for, but your thalamus is just saying, we don't need all of this stuff, just the important stuff's getting through. And so you're kind of ignoring a bunch of stuff that's coming in through your eyes all the time. And just the important stuff, it leads to your actual sensations. Same with hearing, right? You just ignore certain things all the time. Well, that's the thalamus isn't ignoring it. The thalamus is receiving it and determining what's appropriate to actually process as sensations. All right, now on B, below it, you still part of the diencephalon is the hypothalamus. And that's exactly why it's called the hypothalamus, because anatomically it occurs below the thalamus. The hypothalamus is not so distinct a structure. It's pretty easy to tell the thalamus apart from the surrounding tissues because of this. These lobes actually have a shape. The hypothalamus is just a region when you do a mid-sagittal section. But look where the box is on the overall brain there. That's the hypothalamus region, and we're looking at that in detail right here. Now, the hypothalamus does not include the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland is shown here because it works with the hypothalamus. But the pituitary gland is not entirely, I should say, part of the hypothalamus. We're going to talk more about the pituitary in 202, those of you who will be treated to Bio-202, because that's part of the endocrine system. But really, this is an interesting part of the body in terms of organ systems, because this is a major overlap between organ systems. The hypothalamus is part of the brain, and obviously, therefore, is part of the nervous system as an organ system. But the hypothalamus communicates with the pituitary gland via hormones. And therefore, the hypothalamus is also part of the endocrine system. Now, the pituitary gland, by the way, is a two-part structure. Notice that it has two little lobes to it. And notice that only this front lobe, only the back lobe, the posterior part of it, is directly connected to the hypothalamus. The front, which is on the right from your view, is not. And the front and the back have different names. Another name for the overall pituitary gland is hypothesis. Not hypothesis, hypothesis. H-Y-P-O-P-H-Y-S-I-S. Hypothesis means growth below, because it forms like a growth hanging below the brain. And remember in your study of the bones, there was a little caved-in portion at the top of the sphenoid bone. Do you remember what that was called? It means Turkish saddle. You remember this? What's that little indentation called? Sella turcica was the name of the bony feature. That sella turcica, or Turkish saddle, is what the pituitary gland rides in. Okay? So your hypothalamus leads to the pituitary gland through a funnel-like structure called the infundibulum. What do you suppose infundibulum means? I give you these clues. Funnel. It means funnel. So it's a funnel-like structure called the infundibulum. That's right here, leading from the hypothalamus to the pituitary gland. But anyway, the overall pituitary gland is called the hypophysis, another name for it. It's two parts to it, though. The anterior pituitary, which is this part, is also called the adenohypophysis, A-D-E-N-O hypophysis. Well, adeno is a combining form that means gland. It's the only part of the pituitary that truly is a gland. And even though the overall pituitary looks like one structure, it's two separate structures that develop from totally different parts of the body. The adenohypophysis develops from the roof of the mouth. The posterior pituitary, the back part, is also called the neurohypophysis, a name that indicates that it actually is an extension of the hypothalamus. Okay, so the neurohypophysis, this back part, is made up of the endings of the axons of neurons that have their cell bodies and therefore start out up in the hypothalamus. All right? Whereas the adenohypophysis is made up of epithelial tissue, like a normal gland is, and its job is to secrete hormones. Well, the job of the posterior pituitary, or neurohypophysis, is also to secrete hormones, but the hormones that are secreted from the posterior pituitary are actually being secreted by axons of the hypothalamus because of what I just told you, right? Those neurons start out in the hypothalamus, travel down the infundibulum, and then have their endings. Those endings make up the posterior pituitary. So the hormones that are released from the posterior pituitary, and there are two of them that we'll talk more about in 202. In case you're interested, they're oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone. Anyway, these hormones are released directly from neurons, not from glands. And therefore, we classify those as neurohormones. What makes them hormones is that they're not like neurotransmitters. They're released into the bloodstream and they are broadcast throughout the body. Okay? The hypothalamus has a bunch of other neurons that aren't as long and don't extend down through that infundibulum. Those neurons begin and end up in the hypothalamus. And they make up these many different nuclei that you see here as well. Well, the cell bodies make up the nuclei. Well, those neurons, the shorter ones in the hypothalamus, also produce neurohormones. But these hormones are released into a tiny little piece of the circulatory system, which is an example of a portal system, and we'll talk more about this in 202 as well. It's just a little network of vasculature or vessels that lead from the hypothalamus through part of the infundibulum to the adenohypophysis or anterior pituitary. And these hormones traveling through this little section of vessels that are released from the hypothalamus then cause the cells of the anterior pituitary to release still other hormones. So the hypothalamus is the first in line in a sequence of release of hormones. The hypothalamus will release a hormone which then causes the adenohypophysis or anterior pituitary to release a different hormone, which then gets put into the general circulation and makes it all over the body. Those go to different parts of the body and do different things, and in some cases they cause that target tissue to release a third hormone. This happens at the gonads, for instance. Okay, so it's a complicated set of chemical signals that we're calling hormones. But this is the connection point between the two systems. The two major control systems of the body are the endocrine system and the nervous system. And they come together both anatomically and physiologically at the hypothalamus. Okay, the hypothalamus can be considered part of the nervous system. It's also part of the endocrine system. But we'll talk about the particulars, the actual specific hormones in a different course. Okay, now to 13. This color coding of the brain we're looking at, and it's really not the entire brain, it's just the cerebrum, gives you a better view of the lobes that I talked about in the original slide. That wasn't color-coded, though. So now you can see where the five major lobes are indicated. Now, we talked about four of these, the occipital lobe, the parietal lobe, the frontal lobe, and the temporal lobe in the various colors here. And that's really all you see if you're not messing with the brain. If you just look at a brain without messing with it, those are the four lobes that you'll see superficially. But there's also a fifth lobe called the insula, or the insular lobe, which means island. And you have to move away the temporal and frontal lobes to actually see it. It's a little bit deeper. And these lobes do different. They share a lot of things. You know, you can't just assign one list of functions to each lobe. It's not really how it works. They're all involved in many things that they share, but there are things that certain lobes specialize in, like temporal lobe processes auditory information, which makes sense because the ears connect there. Vision, even though the eyes are on the front of the head, vision is processed by the occipital lobe, which is in the back. But anyway, there is a division of labor. It's just not real distinct. Anatomically speaking, notice that among the various sulci, which are the cracks, there's one particular sulcus that is longer than most others. Most sulci are pretty short, or they might take a drastic turn before they end. This one's fairly straight, though, and it's the crack that's between the dark purple and the lighter purple right in the middle. And that sulcus is called the central sulcus. Pretty descriptively, it's not labeled here, but where the two brackets, parietal lobe and frontal lobe, come together, that's indicating where the central sulcus is. Well, a sulcus of any type is between two gyri, right? So the central sulcus, not only is it's called central because it roughly divides the front half of the cerebrum from the back half, but the central sulcus also defines the two gyri that are on either side of it, right? In dark purple, you have the precentral gyrus, left on this figure, notice is anterior. So the precentral gyrus is so called because it comes before, right before the central sulcus. And then you have the postcentral gyrus after that. We'll talk about the precentral gyrus and the postcentral gyrus in terms of what their major functions are in a different slide, but this I just wanted to mention those terms. All right, now to 14. There are different kinds of tracts in the central nervous system. All tracts, of course, as we've been saying, are bundles of axons in the central nervous system. And they therefore are sending signals from somewhere to somewhere else. They're not doing the integrating, like I said, that's done at cell bodies or at synapses. But we can lump tracts that are in the central nervous system into any of three major categories. So there are three types of fibers making up tracts. The first of those is, I mean, just working top to bottom. It's not that there's any order to the three. But the first one mentioned there is association tracts. Now, association tracts, which are the ones shown in, I guess it's reddish, association tracts are not particularly long neurons. They're called association tracts because they join one part of the cerebrum to another part of the cerebrum in that same hemisphere. Now, some of them are long-ish because you can go quite a distance and still be within the same hemisphere of the cerebrum because the cerebrum is so big. But many of them are pretty short because it'll just connect one part of the cerebrum to the right next door in that same lobe, like the ones that just make a little U-loop that you're seeing there. So those are association fibers, and they make up association tracts. The fibers are the individual axons. The bundles of them are the tracts. There are also, though, what are called commissural tracts. Now, commissural is just the adjective of commissure, and I already introduced this term to you last time. What is a commissure? Anatomically, a commissure has something special going on. What is that special thing that's going on at a commissure? Decussation, correct. So a commissure is a structure that allows for crossing over or decussation. And what did I say was the major cerebral commissure? It is the white stuff, yes. The corpus callosum is the major cerebral commissure. That's why I was saying if you take a knife and put it down through that longitudinal fissure, you're really not cutting into brain because the crack is that deep, but eventually you will be cutting into brain, and where you're cutting into brain is where the two halves are connected. That's the corpus callosum. It's not the only place, but that's the biggest and the most important cerebral commissure. So these commissural tracts that you see running from left to right or right to left make up the corpus callosum. There are other commissures, but they're minor by comparison. In any case, a commissural tract has to be a crossing over tract for it to be commissural. Okay, so either sending information from right to left or from left to right. And then the third major category of fibers and tracts within the central nervous system are projection fibers that make up projection tracts. And we can see these labeled right here. I don't know why they used the same color, almost. Actually, when I look at it on the screen, the commissural fibers are distinctly yellow and the projection fibers are distinctly green, but they don't really look that different. Projected. Anyway, the projection fibers are the longest of the three types. And the tracts are correspondingly the longest. What makes them projection tracts is that they connect the cerebrum to lower parts in the brain and beyond, the spinal cord beyond that. And that's why they're the longest. They have to send nerve signals the greatest distance. Okay, so that's why these things are vertically arranged. Projection tracts are vertically arranged more or less because they're sending information to the spinal cord or receiving information from it. Okay, now to 15. The bluish region that's highlighted here, of course it's not really blue, but it's to show you what is included, is called the limbic system, L-I-M-B-I-C. And actually, what all is included in the limbic system is a matter of debate among authorities. So it really depends on whom you ask as to what answer you're going to get of what all is included in the limbic system. Although, pretty much anyone you ask, there will be three important components, at least. And those are shown here. One is the cingulate gyrus, labeled in the upper left. Notice that it's pointing to the band in blue that wraps around the corpus callosum that we just talked about. Cingulate, by the way, is a word that means like a girdle. A girdle is something that encircles something. It wraps right around that corpus callosum, which is why it's called that. So that's one definite member of the limbic system. Another is the hippocampus. Word is in the lower right. And notice what it's pointing to. Does anyone know what the word hippocampus means? It means seahorse, because it roughly looks like a seahorse. And then the third definite component of the limbic system is the amygdala that you brought up earlier. Any idea what amygdala means? What did you say? Yeah, it means almond. So these are things that anatomists name things based on what they look like when they first dissect them and discover them to begin with. All right, so those three things and some others, depending on whom you ask, make up the limbic system. And so since those are the agreed upon ones, those are the ones I'm going to hold you to. But what is the limbic system, functionally speaking? Well, it's part of the brain, obviously. It's highly involved in some primal stuff. Things like rage, fear, extreme happiness. So very strong emotions in one way or another are dealt with by the limbic system. And so it is a evolutionarily, it's a primitive part of the brain. This stuff evolved early on and then became refined as the brain became more and more big in our lineage. But notice also that we have it's not labeled in this picture, but even though it has nothing to do with the limbic system, just because it's a good picture of it, I want to mention something. We talked about the ventricles last time, and remember that the first two are what are those called? Lateral ventricles. So there's a right one and a left one. They're situated side by side, in other words. And the reason they're distinct ventricles and not just one big ventricle is because there's a partition between the two. Well, look at the corpus callosum, and then just below that tan region that's right above the fornix, which is in blue, that looks like a skin, right? It is a skin, a diaphragm of sorts, a membrane. And it's called the septum pellucidum. Now, septum is a general word. Why do we call things a septum? Because it separates two halves, right? Like the septum in the nasal cavity separates the two halves of your nose. And pellucidum is a word that means clear, basically, transparent. Because when you dissect a brain, you can see, if you don't poke through it, which is easy to do, you'll see the septum pellucidum right there in that space. And you can see that, you can actually see through it. It's not transparent, but it's translucent, okay, which is what the pellucidum part of the word refers to. And it's pretty thin, which is why you can see through it, and it's easy to poke through, but that's what keeps the two lateral ventricles as separate ventricles. All right, and then if you do a mid-sagittal section, which, you know, you're doing sheep brain dissections this week in lab, so if you cut perfectly enough mid-sagittally, you might easily see that septum pellucidum, and you can play around with it and see how it's kind of like the skin of a drum. Yeah, I just wanted to mention it there because I don't think it was labeled on any of the other slides. It's not part of the limbic system, though. It's just separating the two ventricles. Okay, now in slide 16, we're looking at a different view of the brain. This is not a mid-sagittal section. What kind of section is this? This is a coronal or frontal section, as you see in the little cartoon with the glass. So we're looking at this thing. We're looking at the back of the brain from the front, that little slice right there. And most of this information is stuff we've already covered. So those are just there as landmarks so you can make your way around. Before I get to the major point of this slide, I want to show you that this is a really good view of the arrangement of gray matter versus white matter in the cerebrum. Notice how the gray matter, when you look at the depth of it, is superficially placed. That's what makes up the actual cortex. That's where all those synapses are. That's why it's such an integrating center. You know, that's where all this really high-level processing is going on. Your deep thought, your personality, your memories, those things are happening at the cortex. Okay, anyway, the major point of this slide is to indicate what are called the basal nuclei, which are important nuclei. Of course, they're nuclei, as the name implies. But actually, I'm glad I said that because older books, and I can only assume that you go out and look at older anatomy books every now and then to check my information. But it wasn't. Older books used to call these basal ganglia, and clearly that's a misnomer, right? Why? Right, there aren't any ganglia in the central nervous system. The cell bodies in the central nervous system are called nuclei, and that's why they officially changed the name, which is, I'm glad, because a lot of times names get stuck in biology and we realize they're bad names, but everyone's been calling them that for so long that we're not going to mess with it. Well, they didn't. They actually changed it to basal nuclei, and that's what you'll see in modern textbooks. So the basal nuclei are important nuclei for various reasons, but I just want to structurally point out what they include. They include, among others, three major pairs of nuclei listed here to the immediate right of the figure. So these three major pairs of basal nuclei are the caudate nucleus. What does caudate mean? It means like a tail. You don't see it in this view. But if you looked at a side view of the caudate nucleus, and I don't remember whether this book has a side view or not, it forms a long tail, the whole shape of it. That's why it's called that. The putamen is next. I actually don't know what that word means, but it's one of the three. And just below that, the globus pallidus, which means the pale sphere. Well, you have bracketing to the right of those. Those are the three pairs, three primary major pairs of basal nuclei. But notice the bracketing to the right of those. Sometimes the globus pallidus and the putamen are combined into what we call the lentiform nucleus. That's just a way of referring to them both at once. Lentiform is a word that means lens-shaped. Once again, it depends on how you cut through the brain as to whether it looks like a lens. But in a side view, it looks more like a lens. And corpus striatum is a word that we give that comprises all three of these. Just one word that means all three of them together. What about corpus striatum? You should be able to figure out what that means. What does corpus mean? Body. Striatum, striped. It's the striped body. That's what it literally means. Anyway, these are basal nuclei, and I'm not going to get into exactly what kind of processing they do. It's good enough to just know their anatomy. Get a good view of the pituitary gland, by the way. And see how it hangs down? Well, it doesn't just dangle. What I was trying to say earlier on the bony part is that it sits right in that Turkish saddle, the cella turcica of the sphenoid bone. So it has its own special place in the skull. Okay, now to 17. What we're looking at here are brain waves in black at different stages of sleep. And when you're aware, when you're not sleeping, in other words, brain waves are fairly frequent. In other words, there's a bunch of ups and downs in a given amount of time. That's high frequency. When you sleep, though, the frequency decreases. But you don't just go immediately into deep sleep, as I'm sure you're aware. There are four different stages of sleep that we define that are indicated here. And so when you're just falling asleep, when you're aware that you're falling asleep because you can feel yourself falling asleep, that's the stage one, the drowsy stage as it's listed here. And your brain is still pretty active in terms of brain waves here, but you're kind of losing it. You're not thinking about moment-to-moment things. You're just letting your mind wander and you're losing consciousness. Stage two is light sleep. And during light sleep, it's typical to see some spikes now and then in an electroencephalogram. The brain waves get spiky, not continuously, but here and there. Moderate sleep is stage three. And that's when the frequency starts decreasing. But you're not into deep sleep quite yet until you get to stage four. And notice that the stage four frequency, there's far fewer ups and downs in that same amount of time compared to what there were when you were awake. So the frequency is much, much decreased. And that is the deepest sleep you can attain. Similar to a coma, similar to hibernation as well, in animals that hibernate, you're pretty much out of it. The difference is that in sleep, deep sleep, you can easily still be aroused with sufficient sensory input. On the other hand, you can't just nudge a hibernating animal and say, "Get up!" It's there, or you can't with a coma either, right? But as far as brain activity is concerned, they're similar. So you still are keeping an eye and an ear out, in a sense, to be woken up, but you're basically ignoring the world when you're in deep sleep. The thing is, once you achieve deep sleep, you don't stay in deep sleep until it's time to wake up. Every now and then, as indicated on the bottom graph, you go into REM sleep. And what does REM stand for? Rapid eye movement. Rapid eye movement is when the most intense dreaming occurs. And your eyes are moving around basically because you're acting out whatever is happening in the dream. But it's really just your eyes and your face maybe that are doing that. Your brain is not letting your body act everything out. You know, so when you're running, your legs are not actually moving. Sleep includes paralysis, intentional paralysis. So it cuts off signals to your muscles, basically, while you're asleep, saying, we don't need these things to actually move. Let's rest them. The paradoxical thing is that REM sleep is not really restful in terms of brain activity. You know, we don't have the whole sleep thing figured out to begin with. It's easy to say, well, we sleep because we have to rest our minds, our brains, but really the brain does never rest until you're dead. You asking a question?
Yeah. Isn't it a theory that, like, when you're sleeping, your brain is, like, trying to keep you alive because you're, it thinks you're dying, so it's trying to keep you alive or something?
I don't know about thinks you're dying. It's trying and succeeding at keeping you alive your entire life. That's the whole importance of the brain. It does keep you alive. There is a restive part of sleep, of course, even for the brain, which is why the brain waves do slow down, but not during REM. The REM is actually more metabolically active than when you're awake. And for some reason, we go into this periodically, intermittently throughout sleep. Yeah. Sleepwalking, I don't know much about. I don't know how that is actually possible in terms of normal sleep. It's interesting. I just don't know physiologically what allows that. Because you can actually be walking around and be totally unaware of it, right? It's not a myth. That actually does happen. Sleep in itself, I mean, even normal sleep when you're not walking around, it's kind of a fascinating thing because you're just, all of a sudden you just lose consciousness and you pretend a different world exists for a while and then you're back to normal daily life. Yeah. I'm saying I don't know why. I don't know what the current state of the art as far as the knowledge of sleep is concerned about REM sleep. But REM sleep is really not so restful for your brain or your body. We do encounter it, though. And that's, like I said, that's when the really intense dreaming has occurred. Dreaming occurs in stage 4 as well, and probably to a lesser extent in stage 3. But stage 1 and stage 2, you're not yet dreaming. And it's the dreaming that occurs in REM sleep is also the dreams that you're most likely to remember. Because I think a typical person probably forgets most dreams. Some people have trouble remembering any dreams they have. Other people vividly remember them. So it depends on the person. But anyway, you can see that your overall sleep is interrupted by a lot of these REM episodes in a typical person sleeping 8 hours. You all sleep 8 hours, right? I know most college students do. Okay, let's go to 18. Once again, a color-coded brain to look at, but now these different colors are not just indicating lobes. They're indicating special areas of the cortex that take care of certain different tasks. And remember, I talked about the central sulcus, which is on either side, and roughly separates the front or anterior part of the brain from the cerebrum from the posterior. Well, also, roughly speaking, that anterior portion of the brain is largely concerned with motor activity, whereas the posterior part of the cerebrum is largely concerned with sensory activity or sensory processing. And therefore, the precentral gyrus, which is the gyrus right before the central sulcus, the one that's in dark blue here, the gyrus is the name for the bulge itself. But functionally, this precentral gyrus houses the primary motor cortex. So motor stuff happening in the front mostly. Sensory stuff happening in the back mostly, which is why the postcentral gyrus in purple, right behind the sulcus, is the primary somatosensory cortex. Somatosensory means information coming from the body, sensory information coming from the body. And so this, remember I said that sensory information passes eventually through the thalamus? That's before it gets to the primary somatosensory cortex. Okay, so it's already gone through the reticular formation, well, through whatever nerves are connected to the sense organs themselves, through the reticular formation, up through the thalamus. Some of that information then, whatever the thalamus allows to go through, reaches finally reaches next the primary somatosensory cortex. And now you're officially in this gray matter of the cerebrum, and this is where the high-level processing occurs, but not all at the primary somatosensory cortex. That receives this sensory information and then transmits it to other parts, mostly in the rear of the cerebrum, called association areas, that will, depending on the information, create sensations. And so that's, for instance, when you finally see. It seems like you're seeing with your eyes. You don't see with your eyes. You see with your brain. You hear with your brain. You feel with your brain. You taste with your brain. The organs that allow that to happen are just the things that cause that first action potential in the neurons that are connected to those organs. Right, that creates the sensory information that travels up through the reticular formation and the thalamus. You're not aware of any of that because sensation is only the aware portion of sensory processing. And that occurs entirely in the cerebrum. Well, evidence that some of it occurs in the cerebellum as well, but it doesn't occur in the thalamus is what I'm saying. That those sensations are created in the gray matter of the cerebrum by and large. And that requires a lot of high-level processing, which is why it's the perfect job for the cortex with all its many, many synapses. Now, there is a region in the front, notice, called the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is where your independent thinking goes on, by and large, about all kinds of things, but including any of your intentions to move different parts of your body. So when you decide that you're going to move something, that those action potentials first are created in the prefrontal cortex. Those travel via association fibers to the motor association area behind it, okay, which receives this information, basically says, okay, you want to do this. You want to move in such and such a way. My job is to figure out what we have to do in order to accomplish that move. What muscles do we need to contract? What muscles do we need to keep from contracting? How forcefully do we need to do this? And so on. That's high-level processing that occurs at the motor association area. And then once that plan is in place, fibers carry the information to the primary motor cortex to actually execute that plan. And that's where the descending fibers that we talked about in the motor pathways start. So the plan has already been devised by at that point. Now it's time to send that information to the appropriate muscles down the appropriate motor tracts, starting out in the motor cortex, primary motor cortex, right at the precentral gyrus. Okay? The rest of it, I guess, I'll have to talk about next time.